Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
You're listening to the FT Money Show, brought to you by Investors Chronicle and FT Money.
Hello and welcome to the FT Money Show. In today's programme, interest rate cuts ahead. So what can savers do to get a better return on their cash? Buy-to-let property? Is it still a good bet as property prices slow and start to fall? Drawing income from a pension, is it a good idea to leave your pension fund invested as markets get volatile? And we have some good news and bad news on life assurance companies. I'm Matthew Vincent, and I'll be giving you the lowdown on all of these money matters in downloadable form with the help of my colleague from FT Money, Steve Lodge.
Hi.
And from Investors Chronicle, John McLeod.
Hi.
So let's start with the money news. Earlier this week, the US Federal Reserve cut interest rates by another 50 basis points in a bid to stave off recession, following its emergency rate cut of a couple of weeks ago of 75 basis points. So that's a drop of 1.25% in just a matter of days. You know, it's the most abrupt easing of monetary policy, I think, since the early 1980s. Everyone now is therefore expecting the Bank of England to follow suit with at least 0.25%, perhaps even 0.5% cut next week. That could be good news for people looking to remortgage, but less good news for savers, or is it? Steve, are there still decent rates out there? Will there be after a rate cut next week?
Matthew, there are and there will be, but of course it is generally bad news for savers. Rates could come down by as much as 0.5% next week, then we'd be down to 5%. But what's happening is banks and building societies are really hitting their back book, you know, existing savers. But anyone who keeps an eye on the latest deals and is prepared to shift can get some excellent rates out there, rates that really don't seem to have moved despite this falling base rate environment. Only this week, an instant access deal, 6.55, and there are still fixed rate bonds, a very volatile market. Providers come in for a few days, then withdraw their offer. And believe it or not, we've got a best buy, in inverted commas, from Northern Rock, 6.9%.
Northern Rock, that bank that's had certain difficulties of late.
Indeed. It's a best buy at 6.9%. That's the highest fixed rate. But it also, unusually, allows instant access, which people who participated in the Northern Rock run, as they say, will be pleased to hear that conceptually, theoretically,
well, less than
instant access, indeed. Now, the obvious question is, why on earth would I want to go within a million miles of Northern Rock?
Well, 6.9% instant access might make me think about it, at least.
Exactly. Fixed rate, falling rates, 0.5% premium over instant access, about 0.15, better than the next fixed rate bond. And this is a one-year bond, but this one-year bond allows you to, in theory, get your money back immediately.
It's a very good deal. And the next best, I think you mentioned, was 6.55% on instant access. So should people have any qualms about going to Northern Rock?
Well, I think fewer qualms than they might suppose. The government's still got its explicit guarantee for all savings, and that includes existing savers who put new money in, and new savers who put new money into the bank. Now, I don't think there's any expectation that guarantee will last forever, but Northern Rock tells me this week that the government will give due notice. So you would be warned that...
And you have instant access, so if you wanted to get your money out, you wouldn't be stuck.
And you have instant access. And don't forget as well, it goes without saying that the government puts so much political capital and taxpayers' capital into this bank that really is it now going to sort of pull the rug away from savers going forward? Famous last words, but I don't think so. And don't forget either as well, in the meantime, since the Northern Rock crisis, since then, since the Credit Suisse, it's increased the industry deposit protection scheme. So for the first £35,000 of savings, you're wholly protected, 100% of all that money. So, I mean, I guess the real answer is put in under 35 grand and you're safest. But there is a catch as well. I mean, worst case scenario, imagine there was a renewed crisis at Northern Rock or a renewed credit crisis. The government might have to temporarily freeze accounts, in which case you might not be able to get your money back within a few. It might take a few days or even a few weeks. I think you'd almost certainly be protected, in which case if you've just sold your house and you're going to buy another house, think twice about putting your entire savings in there because you might not be able to get it back the day the solicitor calls for the deposit and so on.
But that's just generally good advice anyway. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. You know, that applies to all bank deposits.
Absolutely. And don't forget, where Northern Rock went, other banks, who knows, could go in the future.
That's true. So spread your money around, and if you can get over the tarnished brand, the stigma of having a Northern Rock account, you'll get a very good deal by the sounds of it. And for full details of that Northern Rock account, read Steve's Deal of the Week, which is in FT Money with the Weekend FT on the 2nd and 3rd of February and is online at ft.com/money. You can also send in your questions on saving or borrowing or any other topic by emailing us at ask.ftyourmoney@ft.com. Still to come in the programme, income drawdown from your pension. Is there a risk that your remaining pension fund could go down as well? And we have some good news and bad news on life assurance. But first, buy-to-let property. On the face of it, buy-to-let is perhaps not as attractive an investment as it once was, with property prices weakening in many areas. But if people are put off buying, could this in some way provide a stimulus for the rented sector? Well, to get a view on the outlook for prices and rents, Charlene Goff of FT Money spoke to Mark Anderson of Hamptons International.
So, Mark, we've seen a bit more gloomy news come out on the housing market this week. Mortgage approvals fell again in December to actually their lowest level since the 1990s. So what's your view on what's going on the housing market right now?
Well, I think that is further indication of what we're seeing, which is that, you know, there is inevitably a reduction in the number of people who are happy and prepared to go out and buy in this market. Yeah. And I think it's, you know, increasing caution amongst potential buyers, as they just don't know, you know, there is a degree to which they're not sure how far this is going to go on. So it is a concern, obviously, and I think transaction levels are reducing and prices actually are holding reasonably firm at the moment.
And is that across the country? I mean, have you seen any sort of prices start to come down over the last few months?
Well, we're predominantly occupying the kind of, you know, the southern counties of the UK, London, right, and the southern counties. And we have seen a softening of prices as people, you know, aren't prepared to get into bidding wars, etc. But we haven't seen a marked reduction in values. I mean, every local market has its stock that is in short supply, and those houses are holding up very well. But clearly, if it's a property that's perhaps on the fringe, you know, either through an issue it has locally or just in terms of its location, then that's more likely to find that actually it's harder to achieve the kind of price that the vendors might expect to,
yeah,
and might have expected to last year.
And we've actually seen a few people making comments, and especially if interest rates are going to come down again in the near future, that actually this could be quite a good opportunity to buy. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I think this is definitely good news for buyers. They've been squeezed and squeezed for many years now. Mm. And first-time buyers particularly, I think this is, you know, I've always felt very sorry for them, frankly, over the last period. I think this is a good time for them.
Yeah. And what about buy-to-let investors?
Well, again, I think, you know, clearly the latest entrants to that marketplace might be feeling a bit squeezed because they might not have had as much equity as some of the longer-term investors have had. Averagely, it's about 70% in that market, you know, loan-to-value. So it's pretty healthy in that sense. But I think the opportunities, you know, are that there'll be some good deals out there for buy-to-let investors.
Rents on the price side, and actually the fundamentals for buy-to-let investors are looking pretty good at the moment. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Well, you know, you've got rents rising at the moment as there's much more demand for rental property. And we're still actually in the UK. You know, the UK has got one of the lowest proportions of housing stock in the private rented sector of any of the industrial economies. So we're, you know, demand remains high, rents are rising. The demand is coming from an increasing number of students. You know, obviously a significant inflow of migrant workers. And so, and I think that, you know, all the kind of legal aspects of renting, the security for landlords has been improving. And, of course, landlords can look down the telescope of a very much more benign capital gains tax environment for second homeowners.
But I guess the flip side of all this is that, you know, if you are going to go into the market now, you will probably need a significant amount of capital because of the tightening we've seen in the mortgage market.
I think that's another reason why more people are renting, is because actually they're going to have to wait longer to collect the kind of deposit they need to buy. And I don't think that's necessarily going to, we're not going to, I don't think, see a return to the kind of lending, you know, and kind of the flexibility there was in deposits and the amount of deposit. I don't think we're going to see a return to, you know, the kind of heady days of very recently, for some time, actually, even after this credit squeeze has sort of worked its way through.
But if you can afford to go into the market now, it might be a risk worth taking.
I think so. I mean, you know, it's a big step for somebody doing it for the first time. But I mean, the good news for them is it's cheaper than it was last year.
That's right.
Okay. At least in terms of the values.
Great. Well, thanks very much for your time.
That was Mark Anderson of Hamptons International, and Charlene joins us now. Mark's making the point that you have to, you know, meet tighter criteria now to get a mortgage for buy-to-let. But if you do, rental yields could be getting quite a lot better this year.
Yeah, that's right. And it could be quite an interesting time for landlords this year, because on one side you've got interest rates set to fall, so the borrowing costs should come down a bit. In addition to that, you've got rents rising, so they get that extra bit of profit at a lower rate.
And rents rising presumably because more people are looking to go into the rented sector, possibly from the sort of owner-occupier sector, into rented as a temporary measure or medium-term measure?
Yeah, I mean, estate agents are seeing real high demand for lettings at the moment, because you've got people who've sold up who are renting, people who, first-time buyers who are putting off purchasing a property, continuing to rent, and also people moving to London for work who are choosing to rent rather than buy. So there's a number of different groups of people who are really, you know, choosing to rent rather than actually take the plunge and buy a property.
And you mentioned the sort of people moving for work, because the corporate sector's seen a shift towards a preference for rental over purchase.
Yeah, definitely. There's more foreign workers who are coming to London, a little bit nervous about the market, who are thinking, you know, maybe at least for 6 months or a year, they'll just rent and see how things go.
So what sort of rental yields could we be seeing later in 2008?
Well, I think some of the most bullish commentators, Paragon, for example, are saying that yields finished 2007 at a high of about 6.2%. I mean, that does...
But that sound a bit high.
It does sound a bit high. I think a typical yield, you know, has fallen to about 4, 4.5. Maybe they might be coming back up to 5 or so. So still quite tight when you think of current borrowing costs. But they could continue to grow this year. Maybe they could push up to the 6% mark.
Steve, I think you're a little bit sceptical about Paragon's particular view of rental yields, but do you think that there is opportunity still here?
Well, I think it's just worth making the point, of course, Paragon is the sort of embattled, in journalistic terms, lender, is it not, that's just going through an emergency fundraising. But, I mean, that's not to say, I'm not saying its figures aren't accurate. But I think long term, I think there is massive demand still out there for buy-to-let. I think the real story of the housing boom has been that every time there's been this sort of slight fall-off in confidence or slight fall-off in prices, buy-to-let investors have dived in there over the last decade and mopped it up and fueled the resurgence, if you like. And I don't think we're there at saturation point yet. I think many investors, many listeners will like the idea of buy-to-let. They will think that property can only go up in the long term. I think what they underestimate, all too many buy-to-let investors do underestimate, is the horrors of being a landlord. I think it's an inherently fractious arrangement, relationship between
landlords. You've experienced this yourself, I believe.
I have, and I wasn't even paid for it as well. So, you know, do you really want to have that conversation with the tenant about fixing all the things that go wrong in the flat and so on? Everyone knows the arguments about deposits and so on. Tenant always thinks they've been robbed blind. Landlord always feels they should get back a pristine flat. Therein lies the conflict.
But outside the sort of petty disputes between landlord and tenant, this idea that buy-to-let investors come to the rescue of the housing market, I suppose, is borne out partly in some of the anecdotal evidence of auction sales, property auctions, where repossessions are being snapped up by buy-to-let investors.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting because often the people, the owner-occupiers who are running into problems, first-time buyers, for instance, are those that have the exact properties that buy-to-let investors are often keen to buy, the kind of one- or two-bedroom flats, for example. And these are seeing increased repossessions. Definitely over the last 6 months or so, there has been a rise. And auctions are seeing, I think it's 40%, more repossessed property come through, you know, in the last month or so, and saying, you know, their auction rooms are filled with buy-to-let investors looking for a deal.
So not too late to snap up a bargain. In fact, it could be the perfect time.
But the risk is, of course, that if it is a bubble, then this bubble has been kept going for a bit longer until it does burst, because rents might have to come down if people are unemployed.
I suppose a point to make is what we saw in the very early 90s, the last sort of big housing price bubble, when I suppose some buy-to-let investors got burnt. In fact, I bought a flat from a buy-to-let investor who got into trouble back then. But I suppose it wasn't as big a sector, was it?
No, it wasn't
defined as such, was it?
No.
I mean, there were landlords, obviously. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, what's come down in recent, in the boom, correct me if I'm wrong, Charlene, is borrowing costs, this concertinaing, this narrowing of the spread that investors have paid over normal mortgages. In the old days, you had to get a commercial loan, effectively.
That's true. And now you can get a cheaper buy-to-let deal than many owner-occupiers.
Yes, exactly, yes.
And also, even is the bubble likely to burst? You know, people still need somewhere to live. And you have got huge numbers of students and migrant workers coming in. So, you know, they should really buoy up rental demand. But I guess they will be hoping that capital values won't come down anymore.
That's the trade-off, isn't it? Does the rental value make any possible loss of capital value worth it?
Yeah.
And at the moment, it seems that in many cases it does. So, well, for more on buy-to-let, you can read Charlene's story in FT Money on the 2nd and 3rd of February. Coming up, we have good news and bad news on life assurance. Before that, though, pensions. Last week on the FT Money Show, we talked about getting an enhanced income from a pension annuity. But what if you don't want to commit to buying an annuity right now? John, you've been looking at this very question this week.
I spoke to Nigel Callahan at Hargreaves Lansdown about the fact that as more people take enhanced annuities, that means there'll be less money in the pot for those who've got longer life expectancies, so those people might want to look at income drawdown instead. So I started off by asking Nigel about the growth in enhanced annuities.
Last year, for the first time ever, £1 billion was invested in enhanced annuities. It's a way of, because of a client's medical conditions, of getting an increased income of up to 30% on average, more than someone ordinarily would. So it's becoming increasingly popular.
By doing that, you reduce the mortality cross-subsidy, and that means that people who've got longer life expectancies won't necessarily get such good annuity rates.
Yeah, it's estimated that 4 out of 10 people that do retire are entitled to one of these enhanced annuities, but that does leave the other 6 out of 10, the 60%, likely receiving a far worse and poorer annuity rate.
And one way to address this is the growth of the income drawdown market, where rather than buying an annuity, you've got an investment going on and drawing an income from that.
Yeah, absolutely. Income drawdown has become increasingly popular over the last 10 years or so, partly as a result of the perceived poor value of annuities, and that's likely to continue.
One advantage of using income drawdown is that you can maximise your pension and therefore burn down the pot so that on death there's no pot left and it won't be taxed up to 55% or up to 82% in alternative secured pension after 75.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of people that use their income drawdown contract more or less like a bank account. They'll take the maximum they're allowed to from their income drawdown each year in the certain knowledge that that's going to deplete the fund over a number of years, so that when they do come to their very, very old age, and indeed their death, there's likely to be very little left that the taxman can take in the form of inheritance tax.
But on the other hand, the risk is that if stock markets are volatile and come down, you could be left with insufficient pension income when you need it. So what sort of asset allocation do you think people should be using in drawdown?
Well, the first point to make is that if someone is an income drawdown and they are invested in equities currently, they should bear in mind that they only actually suffer the losses when they sell what they own. If they can afford to carry and ride out the market turbulence at the moment, there's certainly an opportunity that the markets may come back and they won't crystallise the losses they currently face. Any investment portfolio should have a broad spread of equities, cash, fixed interest and property investments. And you can often buy that by accessing either manager of managed funds or fund of funds, where you get an investment manager to actually give you a professional asset allocation on your behalf and will monitor those funds each day.
Do you think there's a case for a balance between annuities and drawdowns, so that you've got a bit of certainty and a bit of spice?
Yeah, that's, again, increasingly becoming popular, where someone with half of their fund will get the certainty from buying an annuity. They know they'll receive X amount of income each and every month for the rest of their lives, and with the balance, purchase an income drawdown contract, which will allow them to hopefully enjoy the investment returns, or better investment returns, which will let them take a greater income. And because they're balancing that half with annuities, it will typically allow them to take greater investment risks.
That was Nigel Callaghan of Hargreaves Lansdown. And John, Nigel's making the point about volatility and having a spread of different assets. But I suppose it's not just volatility in the short term people need to worry about, it's how markets move over a period of time. Because if you, let's say, you retire at 65 and go into income drawdown for 10 years to age 75, if you'd done that and invested in the US stock market, say, you'd find that the value of your pension fund was exactly the same at the end of 10 years as it was at the very beginning. So you haven't actually achieved any growth, but you've been drawing an income which reduces the value of your fund. So timing an asset class has got to be the most important thing here.
That's the risk of being in the income drawdown. I mean, obviously, one advantage of it is that you can actually burn down your pot and avoid tax. But then if your other investments have fallen as well, you've got nothing else to fall back on. If you're taking a percentage of your pot each year and you're invested in equities, you really have to be quite careful. So, as you said earlier with Northern Rock, don't put it all in one basket. And when you're in retirement, capital preservation is maybe more important than growth.
And I suppose it's particularly important because if you were to allow your capital to reduce in value, or even if you were to go for that sort of burning down the pot strategy to reduce the value of your estate, the trouble with that is each year your income in retirement will get that little bit smaller, which could be difficult if your costs go up in later life.
In a way, saving in a pension is not a very good way to focus on growth because of the tax aspect. If you want to pass money on, you may be better taking more risk outside your pension. I mean, financial advisors usually say, as a rule of thumb, you should have about the same proportion of your assets in safe investment, in inverted commas safe investments, like bonds, property and cash, as your age. So say you're 65, you should have 65% of your portfolio in those assets, only 35% in equities.
So adjust your asset allocation to match your circumstances. Steve, I think you would also advocate mixing and matching the sources of income that you have in retirement.
Yes, I mean, I think thinking about that, the prospect of 65% of your assets in bonds might sound a bit boring to some listeners. Don't forget, most listeners will have a decent state pension, maybe a final salary pension coming for a former employer. So income drawdown could be something they do with their AVC pot or their SIP or whatever it is. So I think you can afford to take some, if you like that dreadful industry term, the barbell approach almost, you know, and see your state pension at one end of the guaranteed money coming in, index links and all the rest of it, similarly with your final salary pot, and maybe do something racier around the edges with income drawdown. But I wouldn't underestimate the risks. I mean, I think you can take up to 8%, can you not, from a drawdown plan at the moment on the sort of maximum yield basis. So I mean, clearly that could denude the underlying capital very quickly.
And the, you know, the chances of making enough in terms of capital growth to make up for that income you've taken at the moment, the chances aren't that great.
Indeed, we don't need to talk about what's happening in markets for people to realise that.
So for more on income drawdown and the sort of strategies you might want to employ in difficult markets, have a look at the pension special in FT Money on the 2nd and 3rd of February. And finally today, it's good news, bad news on life assurance. Steve, there's been big news, certainly, in the life assurance sector this week with Friends Providence and Standard Life making announcements. Where's the good news in this?
Well, the good news, or the reason it's something people need to focus on, is that these are very widely held shares. Both Standard Life and Friends Providence are two of the most widely held shares amongst private investors, largely as a result of their demutualizations in recent years. Of course, people are also customers of these companies as well. These are the traditional financial services giants. So the good news, if it's good news, is that Friends Provident this week finally announced the details of its strategic review, which basically is to sell off its holding, majority holding in Foreign and Colonial Asset Management and various other bits and pieces of the business. And this follows its failed merger with Resolution last year, which in turn involves Standard Life. Standard Life tried to pip in there and acquire Resolution as well. So it's a terribly murky, incestuous world. And I mean, the other bit of news this week, of course, was a senior executive at Standard Life jumped ship to Friends Providence. To head up Friends Providence, yeah.
And so he's going to be overseeing this sale of assets at Friends Providence. Is there good news if you are one of these shareholders? You know, if you did get demutualization shares in Friends Providence, is this going to boost the value?
Well, the good news is kind of a sort of relative thing. They've been dogs. Friends Providence has been a dog since demutualization in some 5 years ago, and the hope is, eventually, like all dogs, someone external will come and try and break up the company. There's talk of a bid from J.C. Flowers, the big U.S. investor. But I think the number touted has been about 175p, which is still well below the flotation price of about 220. The market's reaction to the strategic review as well was not positive. The shares immediately fell. Friends Providence shares immediately fell 10%. So they weren't impressed. Either they weren't impressed with the lack of ambition in just selling off a few bits and pieces, or they felt that, frankly, it was a bit of a fire sale, or will be a bit of a fire sale, of an asset management arm in falling markets with investor outflows.
So the news isn't great for shareholders in Friends Providence. Standard Life put out its new business figures earlier this week, but no one really paid attention because they were too busy looking at that executive that you mentioned, who's going over to become the new chief executive of Friends Providence. They were more interested in the poaching than the business figures. How's Standard Life's shares been performing?
Again, very badly. The Standard Life shares peaked last summer and have fallen heavily, near 40%, nearly a half since the Credit Suisse last summer. Arguably, they'd become overextended. People had done very well since demutualization, since flotation in 2006 through to mid-2007. Then famously said, this is a fabulous company, it's going places and all the rest of it. And then came the failed bid for Resolution. The city, big investors, have really lost confidence in Standard Life in recent months. That was seen as a botched attempt to get in there and into a merger. But I mean, one rumour going through the mill at the moment is, of course, that Standard Life will now bid for Friends Providence. So good news for Friends Providence. Will it be good news for Standard Life? Obviously, it depends on the terms of the deal and whether it's seen as a good transaction. But I mean, the other thing to say as well is, I mean, new business figures, and it's a terribly opaque world, life insurance. There's all sorts of talk about actually new business is really gross new business, and actually they're all cannibalising each other's products and so on. And it's never more murky, of course, than if you happen to be a poor old policyholder with a with-profits endowment or a with-profits pension.
This is what I wanted to move on to, because shareholders are not having a good time of it. Policyholders, well, they're also not having a great time of it, are they?
No, I don't think that policy, with profits policy performance, will not offer any respite in current markets. I think that's the simple general comment to make. Different companies will offer different returns, but I don't think any of the returns are great. I mean, the whole with profits endowment, the whole with profits pension, it really is a personal finance product of the past, although still a lot of people have big sums in there, of course. Remember, people typically took out an endowment mortgage in the 80s when for house purchase. With profits, pensions were also very popular as well. But it's the overall returns on these policies have been coming down, and the explicit bonus announcements, the annual bonus that they typically announce around this time, probably won't impress, even given what happened to markets last year.
So it's not much good news and a fair amount of bad news in the life insurance sector. And you can actually read Steve's analysis of the sector in FT Money on the 2nd and 3rd of February. And that's all we've got time for in this week's FT Money Show. Remember that you can email your views and your questions to ask.ftyourmoney@ft.com. And we'll be back next week with another financial lowdown in downloadable form. But until then, it's goodbye from me. It's goodbye from Steve.
Goodbye.
And from John.
Bye.
And from our podcast producers, Blue Barracuda.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.